صل على محمد وعلى محمد جل فرج. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. All praises are Allah's, Lord of the worlds, and may His peace and blessings be upon our Master, the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and His pure, immaculate Ahlul Bayt. It's an honor to be back here after quite a break. I think it was last year I was here last. And inshallah, I'll be here for the next 5 nights. The last 3 nights, I have the intention to explore the concept of Messianism, Mahdaviyat. I didn't want to start now because on the third day, when people will come on Friday and Saturday, they may get a bit confused. So if I start on Friday, I thought it's more wise. Today will be a summary, or an attempt to summarize some basic principles that we had covered during the last few sessions that we had, just in case there are some new faces here. Tomorrow I'll explore the concept of Tawheed, and then inshallah on Friday, in a three-part lecture, I'll give some and share some thoughts on the concept of Mahdiviyat, inshallah. Okay. I'll start with a letter. I don't think I've read this letter at such an audience, but this letter was given by Imam Khomeini in the late 80s, and it was written to the then President of the Soviet Union, Gorbachev. And although it's a political letter, however, it's also spiritual in nature. It's a spiritual political letter covering both dimensions. And although it was addressed to Gorbachev, it was an invitation to Islam for the West. And therefore, when this is regarded as an invitation to Islam for a Western audience by a figure such as Imam Khomeini, this requires some consideration. In the letter, Imam tells Gorbachev to research and investigate Islam. And I quote, he says, "Not because Islam or Muslims are in need of you, but rather to acknowledge that Islam's lofty and global values can constitute the means of comfort and savior for all nations, as well as unknotting humanity's essential difficulties." So this is with utmost courage and valor, Imam, he has no doubt in this. He's a faqih, he's an arif, he's a philosopher, he's a mufassir. He knows what Islam is. This was an opportunity for them to grasp upon, but they didn't. Now, I want to focus on four paragraphs in this letter. The last paragraph is the area which I want to then open up a bit. And there are some very delicate points, you know, between the lines. Ayatollah Jawadi Amali, Hafizahullah, has given a commentary to this letter. It's well worth the read. Imam writes, "Our innate nature, the fitra, pulls us towards acquiring perfection in power and knowledge. Hence, there exists pure power and knowledge for us to have been attracted to it in the first place. And that source of all power and knowledge is Almighty God, to whom we are all heading towards, even if we are not aware of it. Because Iyyaka na'bud, only Allah can be worshipped." So here Imam is referring to a very delicate point that he's mentioned in his other works, that even the idol worshipper, that worshipping is to Allah, but he's not aware of it. No entity but Allah can be worshipped. Some are aware of it and some aren't. Man wants to reach to absolute truth in order to be annihilated in God. The craving and yearn towards an eternal life is incorporated within us all, and this itself indicates the existence of an eternal cosmos that is death-free. There's no end to this cosmos. It's post-eternal. In the same way that there was no beginning to the cosmos. It's a very delicate philosophical point that everyone is referring to, which inshallah tomorrow in Tawheed, inshallah I'll mention. Then Imam continues, assuming your excellency, look at the etiquette here, now, Gorbachev, he wasn't exactly a practicing monotheist, look at whoever the address is, look at the mannerisms, the etiquette, so like Imam Khomeini is using, it's very important. Sometimes in these interfaith dialogues or debates, this is lost. Whoever the other party is, one has to really preserve the etiquette. Assuming your excellency would like to research in these areas, that those Irfani areas in the preceding paragraph, you can instruct the scholars of such sciences to refer to the writings of Farabi and Avicenna, may Allah's mercy be upon them, in addition to books on Western philosophy. So now Imam is entering the discussion now. Invitation of the Western audience to Islam. What's Imam's protocol? He starts off. He says, instruct your scholars to read the books of, and he mentions two philosophers. Two Islamic philosophers with very important books, some of which are studied in the Hawza, Farabi and Avicenna. Now naturally, the common lay Muslim, such as me and you, we can't go with these books to the West, to the non-Muslim Western audience, because we may not be qualified. But there are books which have simplified the writings of these scholars. With that at least, if we understand, we can go to invite. Not to convert, just to convey the message. By doing so, by referring to the books of Farabi and Avicenna, it will become evident that A, the law of causation, cause and effect, upon which all forms of knowledge is based, is rational in nature and not sensible. It's not perceived by the senses. And it's important, this cause and effect. All knowledge is based upon it, but it's not perceived by the senses. It's rational in nature. And B, the perception of universal meanings and concepts upon which all forms of reasoning depends is also rational in nature and not sensible, not perceived by the senses. Then Imam continues, also you can instruct the scholars of such sciences to refer to the writings of Sohrawardi. Now see, this next name Imam is mentioning. He's also a very important philosopher, mystic. Imam didn't speak, you know, willy-nilly. Imam was very, very precise. You don't find many scholars with that degree of precision. Even today, when his speeches are shown and broadcast on television, it's as if each word, it's a book of meaning. Refer to the writings of Sohrawardi, may Allah's mercy be upon him, on illuminationist Ishraqi philosophy, so that they explain to you that, now what's the point in Ishraqi philosophy, that Imam wants the scholars to explain, that the body or any physical existent is in entire need of pure light which is sense free. This being in entire need means being dependent upon that pure light, dependent upon it existence-wise. And that pure light is sense-free, can't be perceived by the senses. And that man's inner witnessing of one's self is totally independent from the senses. As one Sufi Arif mentions in a tradition in the Bible, he quotes this in his book in Arabic. He mentions that in the Bible there's one verse which is on a par with many of our traditions too. Zahiruka lil fana, batinuka ana. But Allah is saying, your external side is to perish. Your inner side is me, is I. Which is on a par with the famous prophetic tradition, Man arafa nafsa, arafa rabba. But this witnessing of one's essence, one's true self, it's sense-free. Then Imam continues, he says, furthermore, this is the third paragraph, request your greater scholars and professors. Now, it's one step higher now. Before he would say, request your scholars. Now, in this letter, see the precision of the words. Saying your greater scholars. To refer to the transcendental philosophy of Mullah Sadra. May Almighty Allah's pleasure be upon him. And may Allah resurrect him with the prophets and the Salihin. Now this was praising Mullah Sadr at a high degree here compared to may Allah's mercy be upon him. So that it becomes known to them, those greater scholars and professors, that verily the truth and reality of knowledge is an immaterial existent, and all forms of thought are matter free, and so are not governed by the material and physical laws and rules. All forms of thought, knowledge is an immaterial existent. Now where is Mullah Sadr going with this? Appreciating and acknowledging this, then one appreciates and comes to the fact that you are your knowledge. The essence of what you are is constructed by what you know. Your essence is immaterial. Knowledge creates the I. This is important. Ad-dunya mazra'atul akhirah. The hereafter, the world is the hereafter's farmyard. That farm is you. The farmer is you. The seeds are you. The actions that you do, which become incorporated within you, become incorporated in the immaterial you. Actions based on that knowledge that you have. The yield, the harvest is you. You are your actions. Then finally, Imam says, I shan't tie you further, and shall not name books of the Gnostics, the Urafa, especially those of Muhyiddin ibn Arabi. Because assuming you desire to be informed of the discussions and writings of this great personality, with the first three he said your scholars, with Mullah Sadr he said your greater scholars. Now look what he says for Ibn Arabi. So assuming you desire to be informed of the discussions and writings of this great personality, you must send a number of your genius specialist experts who have a strong basis in such matters to Qom. Yes. Now you see, that it won't suffice for them to stay in the land. So they have to come to Qom. So that after several years, with tawakkul upon Allah, they have to have tawakkul when they come to Qom and study for several years the works of Ibn Arabi. They can become aware of the depth and thinner than hair delicateness of the stations of Gnosis, Ma'rifat. For without making such a journey, awareness of such knowledge is not feasible. Now, at that time, in Qom, to be polite, at best, Ibn Arabi was regarded as Sunni Muslim. To be negative, many predominant trends, even in the Hawza, regarded him a kafir. Today it's a minority, alhamdulillah. And if you do hear of scholars calling Ibn Arabi a kafir, Imam Khomeini has given the answer why these scholars say that many years ago. He said because they haven't studied the classical texts with the right proper mentors. And that's an important issue. Every field, every science in the seminaries, there's ijtihad in that science. In fiqh, the mujtahids in fiqh, we all follow, and there's no question about it, taqlid is a must. But also there are other sciences. We have to follow those who are most scholarly and most knowledgeable, depending on the science. If someone is an expert, a mujtahid in fiqh, it does not automatically mean that they're a mujtahid in aqa'id. It does not automatically mean they're a mujtahid in tafsir, philosophy, irfan, and akhlaq. Imam Khomeini, in his 20s, in addition to being a mujtahid, in fiqh, he was also a mujtahid in his 20s in ethics, irfan, and philosophy. And this we have to pay heed to. Everyone to their own expertise. At the end, Imam says, finally, allow me to explicitly announce that the Islamic Republic of Iran, as the largest and most powerful headquarters in the Islamic world, can easily fill the doctrinal vacuums of your system and state. He's confident. He knows what Islam can do. Allame Hasanzadeh Omuli, who is alive and has ijtihad in a number of fields. He's a very rare breed now. We don't have many scholars like him. He has said that he swears by his life that if one distances oneself, and then he gives a number, a list, and names of a few books. Books of Avicenna, books of Mullah Sadra and Ibn Arabi. If one distances oneself from them, one has barred and prevented oneself from understanding that which was addressed to the Holy Prophet. That means the Holy Quran. Actually, it doesn't mean that you should directly refer to those difficult books because you don't have the preliminary ground, the scaffolding. However, for seminary students, it's a must. For seminary students who have put it upon their shoulders to teach the people the message of the Quran, if they distance themselves from these books, they've limited themselves in relation to receiving the message of the Holy Quran. Now, Islam as an eternal, comprehensive, and the final religion is multidimensional. There's not one dimension to Islam. It has an infinite number of esoteric, inner, internal layers. Infinite, and the traditions do mention them, that each verse of the Quran has 70, 700, in some traditions 700,000 meanings. This is, to just confine Islam then to the superficial, to the prima facie meaning of the external words would be problematic here. You can't limit Islam. There is no end, it's infinite. Now, there's an exoteric side, an external side to Islam, that we all have to start off with. We all have to abide by the Sharia, for example, the letter of the law. We all have to abide by the exoteric dimension of theology. These things we all have to accept. We can't negate them. But to confine ourselves to that external dimension of Islam, you're doing yourself an injustice, especially in relation to your growth. Then enters the esoteric dimensions of Islam. Islam is one reality, they're not two things. But within that one reality, there are dimensions. It's not as if it's three or four or five mutually exclusive dimensions. No, it's one reality. They're not five different subjects or areas or domains. But within that one reality, there are dimensions. Infinite number. Depends how you grasped the external aspect and abided by it and then continued traveling and exploring it deeper and deeper. However, in the esoteric dimension of Islam, here, the aim of this esoteric side of religion, which the Urafa always put upon themselves, this duty to explore and propagate. One of the aims of this esoteric side of religion is for people, the common layperson, to live and breathe Islam from moment to moment, during their lives 24/7. That's the ultimate aim here. Not for them to be in wait of certain dimensions and articles of faith to happen one day in the future, to happen after death, to happen at the end of time. No. That too we don't deny. That's also part of our religion. And we have to accept it. One day many things will happen. One day many events will take place. But for you just to wait for that one day, that's not the goal. Right now, moment to moment, day after day, to breathe and live Islam. I'll explain what that means in a minute, but one has to live Barzakh, Qiyamah, the questioning of the angels, the Sirat, the 12th Imam, Raj'at, all these different articles of faith, instead of waiting for it to happen one day, because when we die after a certain age, then we'll enter those realms. But Islam wants us to experience every article of faith right now in this world. That's the esoteric side of Islam. The external side is only a conduit for one to attain to this goal. So, once a year it's Hajj, but then Islam speaks about the philosophy of Hajj and how one lives as a Hajji day after day. Islam has five salats every day. That's okay. You may cover 10 minutes of your time every day. But then the verse, أَلَّذِينَ هُمْ عَلَىٰ صَلَاتِهِمْ دَائِمُونَ, those who are in salat constantly, it's a code. This is the esoteric side of Islam. It doesn't mean being in doing the ritual constantly 24 hours a day. Which salat is referred to here? What is it that the five salats which are wajib, what is it that they want us, what does it want us to connect to so that we'll be in a state of salat 24/7? to be in a state of Hajj 365 days a year, to be in a state of being Friday lean 7 days a week. These are important. Esoteric Islam, Sufism, has this as its aim. Now, yes, many of you may be scared of the term Sufism, and you're not to be blamed. They've abused Sufism. Many scholars have done that. Doesn't mean Sufism is bad, though. But this is what Imam wants the West to know about Islam. Now, let me go through some examples here. In relation to articles of faith and how they relate to us today. So, death. Is it only something which the people, after a certain number of years, experience? How many types of death are there? What does it mean to die from moment to moment, even in relation to the youth? We have the physical death, okay, that will happen one day. But then we have something called that spiritual death. Islam's protocol, that's esoteric dimension. Mutu qabla an tamutu, the Holy Prophet said. Die before you die. Die that spiritual death before you undergo the physical death. What is this death that the Urafa speak about? Death, we confine it, unfortunately, to that event which happens after 70, 80, 90, 100 years. Whereas death, according to the Urafa, is a transition from one realm of existence to a higher realm. Or another definition is when one travels one step closer to Allah. Zahiruka lil fana, batinuka ana. External sight is to perish. Your inner sight is me. The route to Him is infinite. Every one step closer to Him, you're dying. Moment to moment. That's important to acquire. That's spiritual death. If we just limit death to the physical death, how will that build you? That's not spiritually building. That's not spiritually elevating. But belief in death as an article of faith, وَالْمَوْتُ حَقٌّ, in this context, is spiritually building. And then Islam then brings another formula. It says, أَنَّوْمُ أَخُ الْمَوْتِ, sleeping is death's brother. They share a common mechanism. That mechanism is transition to a higher realm of existence. In our sleep too, we enter higher realms of existences. We all do, Muslim or non-Muslim. We enter Barzakh. We enter Qiyamah. It's all there. Sleeping also is to be benefited from. And then we see that the Sharia, based on the esoteric side of Islam, the Sharia, the exoteric side, comes and says, before sleeping, which means before traveling to higher realms of existences, do wudu, recite a few salawat, recite some verses of the Quran, prepare the soul, you're going and traveling to Him. It's a pity not to benefit. But if you take sleep as just the external side, yes, that's no benefit. That's something which even animals also share with us. Then we have those traditions that say dreaming is a component of prophethood. Because in our dreams too, we ascend. Although these things I have spoken about, this is just a summary of a number of sessions I've had here. Then, the article of faith of Barzakh. Is it to follow physical death? Period? Is that it? Or does it exist now? If it exists now, can it be experienced before physical death? And if it can, how? Here, Barzakh started when you started at 4 months gestation, when the eye started. Barzakh is a dimension of the eye. You're creating your Barzakh from action to action. Your Barzakh is different to your Barzakh is different to your Barzakh. It's different. It's a faculty, a dimension of the essence of what you are, each to their own. From action to action, you're building it. It's in your hands. It's not outside you. It's not outside the soul. Then, it's the concept of the questioning of the angels. What are angels? Sheikh Tusi, in one of his works, says that Iblis was also one of the angels. And then some scholars may come and say, but the Quran says that Kana min al-jinn, he was one of the jinn. Don't you think Sheikh Tusi saw that verse, the explicit verse of the Quran? The problem is that we confine the term malaika, angels, to the technical meaning of it. We see the white physical entity with wings flying from here to there, which is okay as the exoteric side. But when you directly go to the technical definition of terms in the Quran, you lose out sometimes. Because you first have to go to the literal meaning of malaika. And you see that it stems from the radical uluka, which means power. Here, whoever is in possession of a faculty of power, this is regarded as malaika. And then now suddenly the verses of the Quran have to be interpreted differently. See, one has to be precise here. Then angels, are they physical? Do they have physical voices? Or are they immaterial? فَتَمَثَّلَ لَهَا بَشَرًا سَوِيًّا. Lady Maryam saw Archangel Gabriel. What she saw was Gabriel. But the form of Archangel Gabriel, according to the explicit verse of the Quran, was a well-shaped, perfect human being. A human being. It couldn't have been a physical human being, what she saw, with a brain and soul of its own. Otherwise, it couldn't be Archangel Gabriel. It would go against the law of transitivity. Angels have two forms of existences. One is wholly immaterial. But the other form of existence of angels, when they can appear before us in our semi-immaterial Barzakhi realm, that is a semi-immaterial form of existence. It has shape, color, size, but there's no matter. And even in the wholly immaterial form of existence of angels, what does that mean? Because in the realm of pure immateriality, number has no meaning. Divisibility has no meaning. It's one reality. But that one reality manifests and descends upon the semi-immaterial realms of people, me and you. If it's granting knowledge, that's one reality. We call it Jibreel. If it's granting life, Israfil. But the reality is one. Don't bring angels into the physical realm. And then that questioning, sometimes we wait, it will happen one day. But some people regard that questioning as happening from moment to moment, right now. Man Rabbuk, Ma Dinuk. Who is your Rab, your Lord? What's your religion? From action to action, it's being asked of you through the powers of angels. How you act, those actions will be embodied in the hereafter, but it's happening right now. Then we come to the Sirat. Is it a physical bridge? Is it the same bridge for all, or does each person have its own Sirat? You're creating your Sirat from action to action. In a letter to his daughter-in-law, Imam Khomeini writes that the Sirat is here. From action to action, 24/7, in this world, you're creating your Sirat. Then the question is it a physical Sirat? Is it outside the soul, or is this also within you? Chapter 505, Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu alaykum anfusakum. O you who believe, observe your souls. Observe the soul, be careful. Observe it. La yadhurrukum man dalla idha tadaytum. He who strays can't hurt you if you are guided. Who's guided? What is guidance attributed to? To the soul. If that's guided, no one can make you err. Allah Metabotawizi, the Sirat is the soul. It has to be guided though. One who is guided, no one can make them deviate. Then the question of heaven and hell, where is it? Is it a place? Is it physical or not? Here there are differences amongst the scholars whether heaven and hell is a physical reality or an immaterial reality. And it doesn't matter. What matters is our action in this world. So if you hear of scholars saying it's not physical, there's no need to panic. They're not rejecting Ma'ad. The quality of Ma'ad, they have differences of opinion. It doesn't matter. Imam Khomeini, Ayatollah Hassanzadeh Amali, and the Urafa in general don't believe in a physical heaven or hell. They believe it's mithali. And from death onwards, the body isn't a physical body. You have a body in heaven or hell, but it's not physical. It's semi-immaterial. And the more you progress, the more immaterial the body becomes. There is a body though. Your actions create the body. Heaven and hell are dimensions of the soul. You're creating your heaven or hell from action to action, right now in this world. And this is alluded to in the traditions. Some traditions, the angels come and they're creating palaces and castles. They're asked, why are you creating all this? They say, because this person is reciting this or doing this X or Y action. And then they suddenly stop. Why did you stop? Because they sinned. See, action to action, you're creating right now your heaven or your hell. Once Amir al-Mu'mineen, when he was returning from one of the battles, he, with his companions, he came across a skull. He told one of his companions to bring that skull to him. They brought the skull. The physical skull was still intact. Amir al-Mu'mineen asked the son, who are you? Then voices were heard, but the skull wasn't talking. The skull was in the hands of Amir al-Mu'mineen, but the person was talking. He said, I am one of the kings of, I think it was Persia. And to become this king, I had to do X, Y, Z action. And they were all abusive in nature, killing, raping, this and that and the other. Now I am in hell. The person saying, I am in hell now. No, the skull is in the hands of Amir al-Mu'mineen. Doesn't have to be a physical hell. And from moment to moment, the scorpions, the spiders, and so he was going through how he was suffering. But he was suffering then. After death, qiyamah starts. We have a spiritual qiyamah and a physical qiyamah. I'll speak more about that later on. But the point is that it doesn't have to be a physical one. Just because we say it's semi-immaterial, like in our dreams, for example, there's no physical matter. But there is a body in your dreams. Pain is more perfect in the semi-immaterial realm, like in our dreams, than in the physical realm. Pain in this world is limited. Pain is much more in the semi-immaterial realm. In the same way that joy and happiness is much more perfect in the metaphysical realm than in this physical realm. The laws that govern this realm of existence is different to the laws that govern the metaphysical realms of Barzakh and Qiyamah. In this world, when we eat a plate, we become satiated. In heaven, becoming filled up has no meaning. Sleeping has no meaning. Defecation, urination has no meaning. Becoming tired has no meaning. Why? Because becoming tired, sleeping, going to the laboratory, all these are worldly, physical concepts due to the limitations of this world. They don't apply in the more perfect, more immaterial realms of existence. Then some people speak of hell. There's a red monster with horns waiting to burn you, to whip you. Allah doesn't have to punish you. There's no need for Allah to punish you. Why should Allah punish you if you don't do your salat? It's nothing to do with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. What kind of a God is that? He doesn't need our salat. He doesn't need to punish us. These things have to be carefully explored. You're punishing yourself. With every sin that you do, you're contaminating yourself. Those actions that you've put upon yourself will be embodied one day. They're embodied now, but you don't see it. And that's going to cause you pain. But you are the cause. Don't shift the blame to Allah. It's all in your hands. So the rationale of divine punishment has to be explored also. The Mi'raj I haven't discussed with you. It's a series of discussions I haven't yet discussed anywhere, actually. Inshallah, one day. But this is also an important concept. Some people speak of angels coming down, knocking on the door and saying, Ya Rasulallah, let's go now up. By the way, this is Buraq, this donkey. Come on the donkey and we'll go up. Does history record a physical donkey called Buraq? See, these things have to be careful. When you confine religion to the physical realm, it's going to be difficult. As-salatu mi'raj al-mu'min. Salat is the believer's mi'raj. It's there for me and you. We have that capacity. Ascending is something that we all have to do. It's not something which was specific to the Holy Prophet. Then there are debates as whether the Mi'raj was a physical reality. And here, although many of the Urafat do accept that from Masjid al-Haram to Masjid al-Aqsa, there's no impediment to say it was physical, because it's in the physical realm. That's okay. But from Masjid al-Aqsa to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that's outside the physical realm of existence. It's like when you sleep and you ascend to Barzakh and more higher immaterial realities, realms of existences. Physicality has no meaning there. Although Ibn Sina even believes that from Masjid al-Haram to Masjid al-Aqsa, even that was not physical. And he uses the tradition that after the Mi'raj ended, the seat was still warm. And he has a treatise on that. It's a very good treatise, but it's very difficult to understand. And I remember once I told one of my ustads, is it worth me giving this and speaking to the Western audience on this theme? He was very sensitive. He said, no, don't disclose this treatise. I mean, you can find it on the net. But for the common layperson, they can get confused. It's a very deep, immaterial, esoteric commentary of what the Mi'raj was. But in any case, every realm of existence has its own laws that govern it. To ascend to more and more immaterial realms of existence with a physical being, that we don't need to interpret it like that. If it's all physical, you know, there's no spirituality in just going up in the physical world. All these rockets and Apollo, do they acquire spirituality? It's a spiritual journey. The Mi'raj is a journey of the self. You're ascending that infinite you. Your capacity is infinite. There is no end. Jawadi Omri raises questions in relation to the Mi'raj. When it happened that night, he says night has a specific meaning that the waterfall opened up. He says there was no Masjid al-Aqsa at the time. There was a place. It wasn't called a masjid though. And that, he says, it's one of the miracles of the Quran that it later became to be called that Masjid al-Aqsa. But the waterfall then used Masjid al-Haram and Masjid al-Aqsa, and they interpret it in another way based on this. The traditions on the Mi'raj are very sensitive. They have to be commentated upon very carefully. When it speaks of prophets all coming and praying behind our holy prophet, did that happen in this physical realm of existence? If it did, history doesn't record it. Then Ayatollah Jawadi only narrates from and quotes Allama Tabataba'i saying, well, if it was all physical, but Ibrahim and all other prophets, they had passed away, what does it mean for them to come back in the physical form? You have to be careful not to fall in the trap of reincarnation. Many of our articles of faith, if we don't be careful how we interpret it, like Ma'ad, like Alam Adhar, like Mi'raj, maybe we've had these beliefs for years on end, but we're no different in relation to those beliefs based on how we interpret them, no different to what the Hindus say in relation to reincarnation. It's not a joke. Aqa'id is not taqlidi. You can't just say because X person said it, I believe in it. You either accept it, and if you don't, you say, I don't understand it. But you can't accept it just because someone told you. You have to really understand it rationally as a minimum. Then, there's the concept of Raj'at, very important concept that recently I've discussed that in 10 lectures. It would be worth going through those lectures even before I speak about Messianism. It will help. But that is a Raj'at which happens right now, from moment to moment, and that Raj'at is spiritually building you from moment to moment. Then saying one day X, Y, and Z will return, how will that build you? All articles of faith, every one of them builds you spiritually. That's why an aqa'id taqlid is haram, because the knowledge per se is building you. In ahkam, the knowledge per se isn't building you. Acting by that knowledge builds you. That's why there, in the knowledge of ahkam, you can't do taqlid, because the knowledge per se isn't building you. There's no need. Just go to the a'lam and follow. But act upon it. That action will build you. In aqa'id, no. It's not a game. It's serious. You have to either accept it rationally, or you say, I don't understand. There's no sin in saying, I don't understand. Don't reject it, but don't be ashamed. I don't understand it. And there are things which even I may not understand. And then, you know, be embarrassed before Allah sometimes when you don't understand, or you understand very superficially, and then you go on keep on telling people your own beliefs. Be careful. Religion isn't a game. Just first sort yourselves out first, and then go to next step. But don't play around with the articles of faith, because the consequences is high. You can be the cause of waves of people believing in Hindu principles, for example, if you don't be careful. Then we come to Messianism, Mahdaviyat. Now this, inshallah, on Friday, Saturday and Sunday nights, although it requires 10 to 20 lectures, but I'll start it off, inshallah, here. And there are so many delicate concepts, and I'm only going to share one of them with you. But it's a key, it's a device to understanding the traditions on Mahdaviyat. And I'll discuss that in the third of the three lectures. The first two, I have to go through a number of principles, the scaffolding has to be laid before you absorb this point. But Messianism, inshallah, will start on Friday. And there are many issues that have to be covered there. Finally, Ashura. I'll be reciting words of Musibat, inshallah, I think from Friday. But today, with your permission, since I only came last night, my voice is still a bit suffering. But this story of Ashura is important. It's not to be taken lightly. The story of Ashura, like all stories of the Islamic texts, the Quran and the traditions, is the story of the soul. Man's identity was disclosed in Ashura. What is man? Ashura provides the answer. And this happens in all stories of the Quran. It's all stories and dimensions of the soul. They're not just only stories. If it was only stories of the Quran, and you take it at superficial value, well, I'm sure there are other books, historical books, which are much more detailed and will benefit you more. They're all stories of the soul, the essence of what you are, how the soul grows, what man can become, the potential the human soul can acquire. All stories are like that. All stories, including Ashura, is a commentary of the perfect soul, the soul that me and you can become. Didn't just happen willy-nilly. You can't just isolate yourself from it. It's there for the taking. It's there to be quiet within you. If you just confine Ashura to the external dimension, that in the year 60 or 61 after the Hijrah, this happened and that happened, it's okay. All this did happen. And it's okay to cry. It's okay even to beat yourself. It's okay to express that emotional side. No one's denying that. But don't confine it to that. Because if you do, not only would you be limiting religion, you'll be limiting the self. You'll be wasting yourself because you just took the minimum of the message. Now, I'll just give two examples and then we'll go through the story of Ashura very quickly. In the Quran, just two examples just to explain what I mean when we say stories of the texts are stories of the soul, dimensions of the soul, faculties of the soul, what man can be, become, what one's identity lies in. The story of David and Goliath. Talut, Saul, alayhi salam, was a man of God. Apparently he wasn't a prophet, but he was a man of God. He had an army. Part of the army, Dawood, alayhi salam, who was a prophet, was part of the army of Saul. And they went to fight against the enemy, the forces of Jalut, Goliath. Here, when on mentioning this story, we see that in these stories there are codes for me and you to unravel, codes that are spiritually building, not just facts that comes in one and leaves the other. Inna Allaha mubtaliikum بنهر. Saul, Talud said, verily Allah is testing you with a stream. No, this is important. Yes, the external side, the story, there was a stream, it was a physical event, it did happen. Talud said, don't drink from this water. The majority of the army did, they kept on becoming more and more thirsty. They couldn't pass and they didn't succeed in fighting the forces of Goliath. But a small number didn't drink from the water. That's the external side. What does Nahar mean? What does the stream refer to? Yes, the physical stream, it happened. The traditions of the Ahlul Bayt are the esoteric interpretations of the verses of the Quran. إِنَّ الدُّنْيَا بَحْرٌ فَقَدْ غَرِقَ فِيهَا جَيْلٌ كَثِيرٌ. The world is an ocean, and verily waves of people will get drowned in it. In the worldly life, in that dunya bahrun. Inna Allaha mubtalikum bin nahar. You're tested esoterically with the worldly life. Don't drink from the worldly life. Don't get drowned in the worldly life. It's a test. It's speaking to me and you right now. From action to action. The man of God of today is telling us, إِنَّ اللَّهَ مُبْتَلِيكُمْ بِالنَّهَارِ. Allah's testing you with a stream, irrespective of where you are, in Iran, America. Then, the objective in the same story is laid out. فَمَنْ شَرِبَ مِنْهُ فَلَيْسَ مِنِّي. The slogan of the party of Allah, of Hizbullah. Whoever drinks from it is not one of us. It's not one of mine. This is a man of God saying this. This is Allah's party saying this. It's not bound by time or people. It's applicable today, moment to moment, action to action. Don't drink from the stream. Don't get drowned in the worldly life. How? It says, إِلَّا مَنِغَ تَرَفَ قُرْفَةً بِيَدِهِ. Save those who only drink a handful from it. That much of the worldly life, where there may be no Allah in that action, but out of necessity you need it. That doesn't mean don't have a big house, big car, big this. No. You can have all these things, and they can be on a par, albeit difficult, with divine intentions. But there are some things which out of necessity sometimes you need it, and there may be no Allah in the picture, that's okay. But don't get drowned in the worldly life, where actions are done Allah-lessly. That's the definition of the worldly life. Not the world, this world, whatever is here is good. That world which is reproached is in, is the soul. What's one's take on the world and actions, what one's take is. Are actions done Allah fully or Allah lessly? The more it's done Allah lessly, you're exposing yourself to becoming drowned. Or in the story of Nuh alayhi salam and his son, وَنَادَ Nuh. Here Nuh called out to his son, إِبْنَهُ وَكَانَ فِي مَعَزِلٍ. He was standing aloof. So the mu'mineen were in the ark, the floods were covering everywhere. Nuh alayhi salam called out to his son. The code here is the son was standing aloof, separate from everyone. Here the code being story of the soul, story of the threat to one's spiritual downfall here. One of the threats to our spiritual downfall is when we isolate ourselves from the people. And that was where the son of Nuh alayhi salam fell. Because we want to incorporate Allah's attributes within ourselves. How can you be patient, forgiving, generous, these divine qualities, how can you acquire them when you're always isolated from the people? These things have to be grown with the people. But the code was Wakana fi ma'zil. Now, in the maqtals of Ashura, and what happened in the massacre of Karbala, it's infiltrated with codes. It's incredible. It really is. They're so important, these maqtals. That's why I'm saying it's a pity just to confine it to one dimension. Although that's also essential. But go a bit deeper into them. These maqtals haven't become a sunnah and tradition for centuries for no reason. There's a purpose. It's a purpose that this sunnah, this tradition has persevered all these centuries up till today. Okay, in some parts of the world it's gone a bit haywire sometimes. But it's important. Why? Because of the inner message. The more you read about the maqtals, the more spiritual codes to salvation you will encounter. Codes for the fulfillment of the soul. How to purify yourselves, how to elevate. One code is the Qasimi code. These personalities in Ashura, in Karbala, they're dimensions of the soul. This story too, it's a story of the soul. What is the Qasimi dimension of one's soul? What's the Qasimi code to salvation? Here, that Qasimi dimension of the human being is when he says, Ahla min al asal. How do you view death? Qasim was only 13 years of age. How do you view death? Sweeter than honey. So every time you're making a choice in this world, is a choice between either being embedded in the worldly life or you ascend, detaching yourself from the world life, go one step closer to Allah, that transition which we defined as death. That is sweet for Qasim. That's speaking to us right now, from action to action, that Qasimi dimension has to be portrayed. Or Hur. Hur was an incredible figure. Hur was a mighty commander of the oppressive regime for a long time. Maybe the strongest commander of the army of Yazid. He was maybe most prestigious commander after Umar ibn Sa'd. But he was a big figure, he was mighty. Everyone was scared of Hur. What's the dimension, the Hurri dimension within us? Story of the soul. What is it? Some reports say that the only head which wasn't amputated on the day of Ashura was the head of Hur. No one could amputate that. This was Hur. No one would dare amputate the head. They were scared. This figure had a lot of respect. And they said they didn't even bury him there. They took him, they killed him. But they didn't amputate him. They took the body and buried him in their tribe. Hur, he had a vision. He saw heaven and he saw hell. Not with the physical eye, with the same eye that we see in our dreams. But he was awake and he saw it. What made him see it? That dimension of the soul. What did he elevate to? He observed the adab and etiquette before Lady Fatima alayhi salam. Speaking to us now, dimension of the soul. The adab was respected. This is Lady Fatima alayhi salam now. A man of that position to observe the etiquette at such a time, That's the true test. Then he did tafakkur, tadabbur, he thought. By means of that tafakkur, on the scene of Karbala, by means of that adab, he had a vision. He saw heaven and hell. And he went towards heaven. And then he died. But he saw heaven. Mutu qabla an tamutu. Die before you die. He died. Dying means ascension to a higher realm. He saw heaven whilst awake in this world. Habib ibn Malahir, a great figure again. What was his action that we have to benefit and is a dimension of the soul? It was zeal before the Ahlul Bayt. He didn't take any nonsense when people spoke against the Ahlul Bayt. This message and the maqtal of Habib, it started here. He didn't take any nonsense when they were mocking the Ahlul Bayt. He came out. Habib was a great figure. I'll speak more about him inshallah. But the message applies today. We don't take any nonsense when they speak against the Ahlul Bayt. The story of Zainab alayhi salam, ma ra'aytu illa jamila. Although that's an incredible motto, an incredible slogan to have. This is Tawheed at its best. It's a dimension of the soul. It's accessible to all. Inshallah, tomorrow when I speak about Tawheed, I'll mention that. The Abbasi dimension of the soul. وَتَذَكَّرَ أَتَشَ الْحُسَيْنِ. He recalled the thirst of Hussein. فَرَمَ الْمَا. He put the water aside. How does that apply today? What does it mean to recall the thirst of the Ahlul Bayt today, irrespective of whether you are, where you are, and then discarding that water? It's a high domain to reach. These are all codes of spirituality. They all have meanings behind it. And we'll speak about the Abbasi dimension, but in brief, it's that sacrifice that one has before all one's needs. With Imam Hussein alayhi salam, our master, our shaheed, there we see a lot of things happening on the plains of Karbala. Ready to forgive Shimr before Shimr takes his final blow. Where are we? We're not even ready to forgive our Muslim, pious believers when they do a mistake. Imam is Imam, the Imam of Muslims and non-Muslims, friends and foe. Whenever he sees an iota of potentiality that someone can come on the way, he guides. That's the definition of an Imam. The blood of Ali Asghar was being spilled. He threw the blood up in the sky. It never returned back. Why? Because if that blood had made contact, the enemy would have been destroyed. He didn't want that. Those few hours on the plains of Karbala, from the beginning to the end, on the day of Ashura, we keep on seeing people from the enemy's side keep on coming on the side of Hussein. Imam did everything to get every single person who had that iota, that potential within him. And they would come, one after the other. On the plains of Karbala, it was all about Allah's attributes being disclosed by a man of God and companions annihilated in this, in Allah. It's all about Allah's attributes coming to the forefront in a way that it has never happened before and will not happen until the coming of the 12th Imam. Aina talibu bidamil maqtuli. It's all about Allah's attributes being manifested in a way that it hasn't happened before. A maximal manifestation of Allah's attributes. That's the message of Karbala. That's how the soul grows. Now there's a statement that Every land is Karbala, every day is Ashura, or the other way around. And then some scholars have debates whether this is a tradition or it's not a tradition from the Ahlul Bayt. It doesn't matter. It's a fact. This is undeniable. It's a slogan of Shiism. We believe this. Every day is Karbala because we want to manifest Allah's attributes action after action, day after day. It's our belief. Every day is Ashura. Yes, it's a fact. This is inseparable to what we believe. Now, it doesn't matter if it has been, it's come from the Ahlul Bayt or not. Okay, I think I've taken on overboard a bit, but inshallah we'll continue tomorrow. Wa sallallahu ala Muhammad wa ala alihi.